Welcome to the next edition of our speaker series at the Patika Wealth Management Group. This is John Patika Jr. in Clearwater, Florida. And on this call, we're continuing to highlight our new UBS publication series on innovation from new technology in the last 250 years in the United States. This edition is focused on the assembly line, from how Henry Ford transformed the production process and what investment lessons we learned and how it could be applied to today. And my guest today is Sunny Mehra, who's one of our lead contributors to this report. And Sunny also is a UBS analyst that covers both the consumer discretionary and staples sectors here at UBS. So Sunny, welcome to the call.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I appreciate you joining us, and great job on the report. I think all of these reports that you guys have been doing up and your research department have been excellent. And just to get it kicked off, I mean, could you provide us with just a brief history of the assembly line here in the United States?
Sure. So I'll start very globally. Way back, I mean, shipmakers back in Venice in like the 12th century would use the canals to essentially produce their warships. They would kind of add components as, you know, the body of the ship or the ship went down the canal. And that's kind of one of the earliest areas that we could find an example of this. And then you fast forward to the late 18th century here in the U.S., and it was really the meatpackers, where steam engine, you know, essentially powered the conveyor belt down and carried the carcasses down the line. And you know, as the joke goes, this is essentially a disassembly line. But it did have, you know, people stationed at one point doing one task at one time, essentially. And so that was kind of the, in the U.S., the modern version. This was really inspiration for Ford, for Henry Ford's assembly line in the early 1900s in 1913. Ford applied electrification to the factory floor, essentially. You know, the assembly line needed somebody to rethink the factory floor, and he really did. And he used, you know, the key was using standardization of the inputs, but also of the final output, using labor-saving machinery, especially electric motors, to get economies of scale. Because even the output being standardized, you know, for many years, the only color Ford offered customers was black, right? That's for many years. As Henry Ford did this to the assembly line, the production time to produce a single car went from over 12 hours to under 2 hours, so basically about an hour and a half. And Ford's auto production went from about 10,000 cars a year to over 2 million in just over a decade. So it was an incredible amount of productivity there. You know, wages went up, Ford's profits went up. There was some downside that, you know, skilled craftsmen became laborers who had unskilled jobs, and there was some high turnover in the interim. But Ford doubled wages, and then they saw turnover go down dramatically. And as that turnover went down, it made the entire operation much more productive. And so at the end of the day, it lowered the cost for owning a car. You had rising incomes in the country, lowering costs of producing a car, and that essentially, you know, enabled mass adoption of vehicle ownership dramatically over the decades since the launch of the Model T. And then, you know, eventually from there, the assembly line moved to other products. That's essentially the history of how it started on the auto side.
So over time, obviously, new technologies come about, and we've had globalization has expanded during the time since Henry Ford. So how has those factors impacted assembly lines?
Yes, as you know, as we look past kind of the Model T era, the assembly line grew. It helped enable mass consumer durable products, essentially. You know, it allowed for the low-cost production of these. It boosted worker incomes. It generated profits for industry that were reinvested as well. And if you think of like the modern way of living, so beyond cars, like any household appliances, consumer durable goods, all of these things were really enabled by, you know, appliances. These were all enabled by the assembly line. And essentially what happened is it got more efficient, and the expertise and technical knowledge and skills, they've been able to be, you know, transferred or learned elsewhere as well. You know, the U.S. was a leader, but you've also seen a hollowing out of manufacturing in the U.S. over time and a shift to lower cost countries just because the labor costs are so much cheaper, essentially. And it wasn't really unique to the U.S. You saw this with other developed countries as well, just a shift to cheaper areas of production. We've seen economies of scale as well. You take the auto industry by itself. Like, I want to give an example here. You know, instead of producing many models in one country, the largest auto producers essentially kind of made economies of scale globally, right? So you produce one type of car in one area and you export that. So take an example of BMW. It makes a huge portion of its global SUV production right here in the US. And more than half of that is exported. That's just an auto example, but throughout other sectors, you've seen that kind of mass economies of scale where a single plant or single area producing a single type and other exports around the world, you've seen that kind of globally. And the auto industry was, you know, was a leader in that, but you've seen it in many others. And the assembly line nowadays is just much more digitally integrated, much more efficient for large volumes, and it has robotics and built-in flexibility. I mean, that built-in flexibility becomes key as you retool it. You know, for auto industry, you're essentially retooling for a new model every 5-7 years. You know, many updates to a model can happen every year or two. So you have to have some amount of ability to retool, like diagnose issues and fix issues as well.
Well, let's talk about automation and robotics, because obviously that's a pretty hot topic now. And, you know, as manufacturing becomes more automated and we get more robots on the job site, what kind of jobs for humans? I mean, is the human workforce going to shrink significantly, go be non-existent in these manufacturing plants? I mean, what's that going to look like?
That's a great question. And, you know, the short answer is it's not going to be, you know, humans will always be needed in one shape or form. But the job specifications and the qualifications and the training involved, et cetera, will all change. And look, we've already seen some evolution. It's not like robotics are completely new. They've been introduced, you know, over time, and you've seen kind of a gradual upskilling. And we think that'll essentially accelerate for the types of jobs on the assembly line. Look, there's a renewed focus in this country, in the US, on reshoring, hardening supply chain, essentially building up military readiness as well. And automation AI will be a big component of that, but that doesn't mean jobs will go away. It does mean we could see manufacturing output may increase. In total, it might increase as a percent of GDP, even as employment in the sector doesn't increase a whole lot. But I think that will really just come from the efficiency of the job application of what humans do. And look, robotics is huge. Jensen Huang, NVIDIA CEO, said earlier in January this year that the ChatGPT moment for robotics is here. And if you look at the U.S., you know, the stats we have is that the U.S. only has 30 robots for 1,000 manufacturing jobs, and that's steadily increasing, and we would expect that to continue to increase. You also have cobots, which are collaborative robots who work side-by-side with humans. That's also increasing. And if you take some companies out there, they're trying to reshape kind of the entire system. I mean, a lot of people compare Tesla as a little bit of a modern-day Ford in the Model T era, because it's much more vertically integrated than other Western auto manufacturers. And it's working on like a modular assembly line where you have feeder lines going into a final assembly, which it says will be quicker than the industry standard of, you know, a car being produced every 69 seconds. It remains to be seen if they can do that. But there is other parallels in which the Tesla is already much more vertically integrated. They own a lithium refining plant here in the U.S. So it does have some parallels to that Model T era, which they're trying to rejigger essentially the assembly process. One other thing I want to say is another area we're really watching for, and it's really taken off the past maybe year or two, is the humanoid sector. And these are essentially robots with the human form. And unlike maybe other robotics, these are more general purpose robots, essentially, you know, so robots that could do multiple tasks as opposed to a single repetitive task. And you can imagine, you know, the market for this would be huge if it ever gets perfected. In the interim, though, it's a very tough nut to crack, because especially the hands, you know, if you think of the degrees of freedom in your hand with the pinching and grasping and twisting, it's just very hard to essentially master. And the cost per production for a humanoid right now is still very high. I'm over $150,000 per McKinsey per unit. But if you think of, you know, over the coming decades, our aging demographics, you know, labor scarcity, job preferences, you know, the younger generations don't really want to work in manufacturing as much. This could be a huge opportunity to whoever kind of cracks the nut on humanoids.
Yeah. And side note, I was watching Honey, I Shrunk My Kids with my kids the other day, and it was the first time they ever seen it. And they had a scene in there where they had the neighbor kid come over into the backyard, and the scientist's son built this lawnmower that was remote controlled. And I'm looking at it, I'm like, man, this is supposed to be so futuristic. Like, we've already got those, you know, the Roomba that's cutting the grass.
Yeah.
Amazing how fast technology has progressed. You know, these old movies, they're not that far-fetched.
Exactly, exactly. You see a lot of parallels in small movies like that.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about investment opportunities with the way technology has been advancing. We've talked about, you know, it's great that we have robotics and we could produce more, but how does that relate to the investor and how we can make money?
Great question. And one other thing I just point out, which I didn't mention on the previous part, like it's been a while. Like the U.S. has moved over time to more of a services-based economy, right? Like that's just been a trend that we've seen over a long period of time. And it's not like even with the increase in reshoring and the focus on hardening supply chains, it's not like that's shifting anytime soon. You know, we are becoming just more efficient with the manufacturing side. When you talk about, you know, investment opportunities, I would say, you know, the companies that have the resources that are investing in technology and taking multiple years and even decades of foresight. When you look at companies, say, let's take Amazon as an example, they were very early to invest in automation and robotics. Even if you look at their headcount, it's actually down from the COVID era peak of 2021. So they've actually kept headcount flat down over those years as sales have gone up a lot. A lot of that's just more automation, more investment, robotics in the warehouses. You're seeing other companies like Walmart as well doing the same thing. For these types of investments, you need billions, if not tens of billions of dollars at the large scale. And so a lot of companies, when you say the investment opportunities, there is a little bit of the larger companies have an easier path because there is a cost to do this, obviously. And there is also a timeline that you have to be able to look years in the future and not expect to pay off quarter ahead. So the companies with the resources that can have that, they're the ones that are investing. So we're seeing that in the retail sector with those that are investing in warehouse capability and speed of delivery and those types of things. So we're seeing that, you know, a retail, I cover the consumer sector. So within consumer, the retail sector, the goods, more of the goods related sectors, you see that more in terms of the investment in automation, robotics, AI. But that's not to say that, you know, it's happening in all other areas as well, you know, if I take my consumer areas, but you're really seeing it. It's very tangible, you could say, and you're starting to see the improvements. I mean, you see it as a customer, the speed of delivery you can get now from different online retailers. And I also point out, you know, our artificial intelligence power resources trios, they capture lots of opportunities throughout the assembly line as well.
Can we talk a little bit and shift gears into the home improvement sector? You know, it feels like as technology is evolving and, you know, AI and the robots, I'd just like to talk a little bit about the home improvement sector. And I just feel like, you know, plumbing and HVAC and companies like that are going to survive through all of this innovation. What do you think?
I think that's largely correct. Exactly. And home improvements, it's interesting because it's one of these sectors that people argue, I mean, if you take housing more broadly, you haven't really seen much advancement in technology automation relative to other sectors, right? When I look at the auto sector or other sectors, you spoke about appliances, you still have a lot of people, when you look at like a new house being built and you drive down the street, it's not that dissimilar from decades ago. And there is this hope, at least in the future, that eventually we'll figure out a way of making it more efficient to build a house, essentially, and reduce the cost of building a house, which can actually help affordability and it would help the housing shortage, et cetera, et cetera. But so far, and what we've seen on the housing front, at least, is that it's very tough. You're seeing some modular, you know, housing, you're seeing a little bit of that, but it's not, you know, it's not huge. And to get back to your home improvement, you know, on the home improvement side itself, I think you're largely right. I mean, you need all these types of players will largely survive. You haven't seen much, you know, these are systems that were created a while ago, and it's not like they're changing that rapidly. And there's a big opportunity in some parts of that because of electrification going on.
Mm-hmm. And then can we also talk a little bit about, you know, you mentioned Walmart, and, you know, Walmart is just obviously has had a great run over the last few years since COVID and, you know, the amount of groceries these guys sell. And you mentioned like these big companies, they've got the money that they could pay to buy this new technology and these robotics. Can smaller and mid-sized companies compete with the likes of Walmart and Coca-Cola? Because they've got all these big cash reserves that they can make these investments. I mean, is the small and the mid-cap companies, I mean, do they just not have a chance against these guys?
It's a great question. I don't want to generalize for all. I would just say, on average, it's tougher. It is, because you need the financial resources, and you also need to have the runway, basically the timeline, to be able to see it through. And so if you're under pressure to deliver, say, in 6 months or a year or whatever it is, it's much tougher. And if you don't have the capability, if you can't invest, I mean, take Amazon, for example. Numerous times in its life cycle, including this year, it'll be free cash flow negative, right? But if you take a long-term view, people look through that, as long as you're willing to take a longer-term view. And I think it's harder for some of the smaller companies on average. I'm not saying all, but for the most part, it is getting a little tougher. And there is becoming, even within the sectors, more and more economies of scale and essentially concentration of market shares, even within the subsectors. You talked about home improvement. The largest players in home improvement are gaining share. You talk about grocery. The largest players are gaining share. If you talk about online retail, the largest players are gaining share. And part of that is they're able to invest so much in this automation and essentially make it easier for the customer and make it cheaper for the customer. And so the customer votes with their feet.
Mm-hmm. Which kind of brings me to my next question. Obviously, we've had significant inflation over the last few years, and it's still going to some of these fast food places or getting a cup of coffee. It's pretty crazy the amount of prices that you pay out there. And you know, at some point, I know it's going to get to a tipping point where it can't keep increasing like this, because like you said, people are going to vote with their feet and they're going to go somewhere else. But how are these big stores like Starbucks, like, I mean, how are they keeping their margins down where they actually can make money with in a Chipotle too, with the food inflation going on? How do these guys handle that?
That's a very good question as well. And I would say it's getting tough because you've seen so much inflation since kind of pre-COVID timeframe, right? And I think the one thing that's helping right now for them is that wage inflation has been a little bit muted. It's not good for the customer, you know, from the consumer standpoint, the demand standpoint as much, but from the company standpoint, the other parts, like you have inflation in like utility costs and insurance costs. And like you said, like the input costs, like beef, et cetera, right? But the one thing is you saw the wage inflation really spike and it's coming back down. And that's been kind of fine now for the past year plus. And so that part's not hurting them as much. The other parts is still reasonably inflationary and definitely above the Fed's target. But I think they've just done a good job with finding efficiencies elsewhere to offset that, to keep the lease margins in some reasonable level of stability, let's say. Not necessarily, you know, each of them is not growing margins necessarily, but they're keeping them at least stable in this environment when, with, like you said, inflation is above in many different categories.
Well, as we're getting closer to the end of our call, I just want to remind our listeners that if you'd like to have Sonny's report on the assembly line, you can go onto our website and reach out to our team. We could send you that next report. Or if you want his most preferred list, we have that too in both the staples and discretionary sectors. You just reach out to one of our team members. We'll be able to send that over along with some commentary that Sonny has. But Sonny, any final thoughts before we wrap up our call today?
I appreciate you having me on, John. I would just say, look, like when people look to the future, it's always hard to predict, right? The way let's call it the new AI automated with advanced robotics assembly line will go. And it's always hard to predict which specific jobs will be there, which won't. But, you know, it's just part of technological progress and we'll adapt. It's not like humans. Jobs will go away and it'll just be a different form of working is kind of the conclusion I want to leave, as opposed to like, you know, it's going to be no humans and all machines kind of thing.
That's the Terminator. That would be the judgment
yep.
day when we get to that point.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Sonny, I really appreciate you spending time with us. It was very informative. And once again, for anyone listening, feel free to reach out to our team or go to the Patika Wealth Management Group website. And we'll be able to get you that assembly line report. So this concludes our call. Thank you again, Sonny.
Thanks, Russ.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC registered broker dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.
This podcast was edited by Resonate Recordings.